2. Richard Tozier takes a powder. Rich felt like he was doing pretty good, until the vomiting started. He had listened to everything Mike Hanlon told him, said all the right things, answered Mike's questions, even asked a few of his own. He was vaguely aware that he was doing one of his voices, not a strange and outrageous one, like those he sometimes did on the radio. Kinky Briefcase, Sexual Accountant, was his own personal favorite, at least for the time being. And positive listener response on Kinky was almost as high as for his listener's all-time favorite, Colonel Buford Kiss Drivel. But a warm, rich, confident voice. An I'm all right voice. It sounded great, but it was a lie. Just like all the other voices were lies. How much do you remember, Rich? Mike asked him. Very little, Rich said, and then paused. Enough, I suppose. Will you come? I'll come, Rich said, and hung up. He sat in his study for a moment, leaning back in the chair behind his desk, looking out at the Pacific Ocean. A couple of kids were down on the left, horsing around on their surfboards, not really riding them. There wasn't much surf to ride. The clock on the desk, an expensive LED quartz that had been a gift from a record company rep, said that it was 5:09 p.m. on May 28, 1985. It would, of course, be 3 hours later where Mike was calling from. Dark already. He felt a prickle of goose flesh at that, and he began to move, to do things. First, of course, he put on a record. Not hunting, just grabbing blindly among the thousands racked on the shelves. Rock and roll was almost as much a part of his life as the voices, and it was hard for him to do anything without music playing, and the louder the better. The record he grabbed turned out to be a Motown retrospective. Marvin Gaye, one of the newer members of what Rich sometimes called the All Dead Band, came on singing, I heard it through the grapevine. Ooh-hoo, I bet you're wondering how I knew. Not bad, Rich said. He even smiled a little. This was bad, and it had admittedly knocked him for a loop, but he felt that he was going to be able to handle it. No sweat. He began getting ready to go back home, and at some point during the next hour it occurred to him that it was as if he had died and had yet been allowed to make all of his own final business dispositions, not to mention his own funeral arrangements. And he felt as if he was doing pretty good. He tried the travel agent he used, thinking she would probably be on the freeway and headed home by now, but taking a shot on the off chance. For a wonder, he caught her in. He told her what he needed, and she asked him for 15 minutes. I owe you one, Carol, he said. They had progressed from Mr. Tozier and Ms. Feeney to Rich and Carol over the last 3 years, pretty chummy, considering they had never met face to face. All right, pay off, she said. Can you do Kinky Briefcase for me? Without even pausing, if you had to pause to find your voice, there was usually no voice there to be found. Rich said, Kinky Briefcase, Sexual Accountant here. I had a fellow come in the other day who wanted to know what the worst thing was about getting AIDS. His voice had dropped slightly. At the same time, its rhythm had speeded up and become jaunty. It was clearly an American voice, and yet it somehow conjured up images of a wealthy British colonial chappie who was as charming in his muddled way as he was addled. Rich hadn't the slightest idea who Kinky Briefcase really was, but he was sure he always wore white suits, red Esquire, and drank things which came in tall glasses and smelled like coconut-scented shampoo. I told him right away, trying to explain to your mother how you picked it up from a Haitian girl. Until next time, this is Kinky Briefcase, Sexual Accountant, saying, you need my card if you can't get hard. Carol Feeney screamed with laughter. Ah! That's perfect! Perfect! My boyfriend says he doesn't believe you could just do those voices. He says it's got to be a voice filter gadget or something. Just talent, my dear, Rich said. Kinky Briefcase was gone. W.C. Fields, top hat, red nose, golf bags, and all was here. I'm so stuffed with talent, I have to plug up all my bodily orifices to keep it from just running out like, well, just running out. She went off into another screamy gale of laughter, and Rich closed his eyes. He could feel the beginnings of a headache.
Be a dear and see what you can do, would ya?
He asked, still being W.C. Fields, and hung up on her laughter. Now he had to go back to being himself, and that was hard. It got harder to do that every year. It was easier to be brave when you were someone else. He was trying to pick out a pair of good loafers and had about decided to stick with sneakers when the phone rang again. It was Carol Feeney, back in record time. He felt an instant urge to fall into the Buford Kissdrivel voice and fought it off. She'd been able to get him a first-class seat on the American Airlines red-eye nonstop from LAX to Boston. He would leave L.A. at 9:03 p.m. and arrive at Logan about 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. Delta would fly him out of Boston at 7:30 a.m. and into Bangor, Maine, at 8:20. She'd gotten him a full-size sedan from Avis, and it was only 26 miles from the Avis counter at Bangor International Airport to the Derry Town Line. Only 26 miles, Rich thought. Is that all, Carol? Huh? Maybe it is, in miles, anyway. But you don't have the slightest idea how far it really is to Derry. And I don't either. But oh, God. Oh, dear God. I am going to find out. I didn't try for a room because you didn't tell me how long you'd be there, she said. Do you? No, no. Let me take care of that, Rich said. And then Buford Kissdrivel took over.
You've been a peach, my dear. A Georgia peach, of course.
He hung up gently on her. Always leave him laughing. And then dialed 207-555-1212 for State of Maine directory assistance. He wanted a number for the Derry Town House. God, there was a name from the past. He hadn't thought of the Derry Town House in, what, 10 years? 20? 25 years, even. Crazy as it seemed, he guessed it had been at least 25 years. And if Mike hadn't called, he supposed he might never have thought of it again in his life. And yet, there had been a time in his life when he had walked past that great red brick pile every day. And on more than one occasion, he had run past it, with Henry Bowers and Belch Huggins and that other big boy, Victor somebody or other, in hot pursuit, all of them yelling little pleasantries like, "We're gonna get you, fuckface! Gonna get you, you little smartass! Gonna get you, you four-eyed faggot!" Had they ever gotten him? Before Rich could remember, an operator was asking him what city, please. "In Derry, operator." Derry. Oh, God. Even the word felt strange and forgotten in his mouth. Saying it was like kissing an antique. "Do you have a number for the Derry townhouse?"
"One moment, sir."
No way. It'll be gone. Raised in an urban renewal program. Changed into an Elks Hall or a Bolodrome or an Electric Dreamscape video arcade. Or maybe burned down one night when the odds finally ran out on some drunk shoe salesman smoking in bed. All gone, Richie. Just like the glasses Henry Bowers always used to rag you about. Oh, what's that Springsteen song say? Glory days. Gone in the wink of a young girl's eye. What young girl? Why, Bev, of course. Bev. Changed the townhouse might be, but gone it apparently was not, because a blank robotic voice now came on the line and said,
"The number is 9-4-1-8-2-8-2. Repeat. The number is."
But Rich had gotten it the first time. It was a pleasure to hang up on that droning voice. It was too easy to imagine some great globular directory assistance monster buried somewhere in the earth, sweating rivets and holding thousands of telephones and thousands of jointed chromium tentacles, the Ma Bell version of Spidey's nemesis, Dr. Octopus. Each year, the world Rich lived in felt more and more like a huge electronic haunted house in which digital ghosts and frightened human beings lived in uneasy coexistence. Still standing, to paraphrase Paul Simon, still standing after all these years. He dialed the hotel he had last seen through the horn-rimmed spectacles of his childhood. Dialing that number, 1-207-941-8282, was fatally easy. He held the telephone to his ear, looking out his study's wide picture window. The surfers were gone. A couple was walking slowly up the beach, hand in hand, where they had been. The couple could have been a poster on the wall of the travel agency where Carol Feeney worked. That was how perfect they were. Except that was for the fact they were both wearing glasses.
Gonna get you, fuckface. Gonna break your glasses.
Chris, his mind sent up abruptly. His last name was Chris. Victor Chris. Oh, Christ. That was nothing he wanted to know, not at this late date. But it didn't seem to matter in the slightest. Something was happening down there in the vaults. Down there where Rich Tozier kept his own personal collection of golden oldies. Doors were opening. Only they're not records down there, are they? Down there, you're not Rich Records Tozier, hotshot KLAD DJ and the man of 1,000 voices, are you? And those things that are opening, they aren't exactly doors, are they? He tried to shake these thoughts off. The thing to remember is that I'm okay. I'm okay. You're okay. Rich Tozier's okay. Could use a cigarette is all. He'd quit 4 years ago, but he could use one now, all right. They're not records, but dead bodies. You buried them deep. Now there's some kind of crazy earthquake going on, and the ground is spitting them up to the surface. You're not Rich Records Tozier down there. Down there, you're just Richie Four Eyes Tozier. And you're with your buddies. And you're so scared it feels like your balls are turning into Welch's grape jelly. Those aren't doors. And they're not opening. Those are crypts, Richie. They're cracking open. And the vampires you thought were dead are all flying out again. A cigarette, just one. Even a Carlton would do, for Christ's sweet sake. Gonna get you, Four Eyes. Gonna make you eat that fucking book bag.
Townhouse,
a male voice with a Yankee tang said. It had traveled all the way across New England, the Midwest, and under the casinos of Las Vegas to reach his ear. Rich asked the voice if he could reserve a suite of rooms at the townhouse beginning tomorrow. The voice told him he could, and then asked him for how long. I can't say. I've got... He paused briefly, minutely. What did he have, exactly? In his mind's eye, he saw a boy with a tartan book bag running from the tough guys. He saw a boy who wore glasses, a thin boy with a pale face that had somehow seemed to scream, "Hit me! Go on and hit me!" in some mysterious way to every passing bully. "Here's my lips! Mash them back against my teeth! Here's my nose! Bloody it for sure and break it if you can! Box an ear so it swells up like a cauliflower! Split an eyebrow! Here's my chin! Go for the knockout button! Here are my eyes, so blue! And so magnified behind these hateful, hateful glasses, these horn-rimmed specks, one bow of which is held on with adhesive tape. Break the specks, drive a shard of glass into one of these eyes, and close it forever. What the hell?"
He closed his eyes and said, "I've got business in Derry, you see. I don't know how long the transaction will take. How about 3 days with an option to renew?"
"An option to renew?"
the desk clerk asked doubtfully, and Rich waited patiently for the fellow to work it over in his mind.
"Oh, I get you. That's very good.
Thank you, and I hope
you can vote for us in November," John F. Kennedy said. "Jackie wants to do over the Oval Office, and I've got a job all lined up for my brother Bobby."
"Mr. Tozier?"
"Yes."
"Oh, okay." Somebody else got on the line there for a few seconds. Just an old pal from the DOP, Rich thought. That's dead old party, in case you should wonder. Don't worry about it.
A shudder worked through him, and he told himself again, almost desperately, "You're okay, Rich."
"Yeah, I heard it too," Rich said. "It must have been a line crossover. How are we looking on that room?"
"Oh, there's no problem with that," the clerk said. "We do business here in Derry, but it really never booms."
"Is that so?"
"Aye."
The clerk agreed, and Rich shuddered again. He'd forgotten that, too, that simple northern New Englandism for yes. "Oh, aye."
"Gonna get you, creep,"
the ghostly voice of Henry Bowers screamed, and he felt more crypts cracking open inside of him. The stench he smelled was not decayed bodies, but decayed memories, and that was somehow worse. He gave the townhouse clerk his American Express number and hung up. Then he called Steve Koval, the KLAD program director.
"What's up, Rich?"
Steve asked. The last Arbitron ratings had shown KLAD at the top of the cannibalistic Los Angeles FM rock market, and ever since then, Steve had been in an excellent mood. Thank God for small favors.
"Well, you might be sorry you asked," he told Steve. "I'm taking a powder."
"Taking?" He could hear the frown in Steve's voice. "I don't think I get you, Rich."
"I have to put on my boogie shoes. I'm going away."
"What do you mean, going away? According to the log I have right here in front of me, you're on the air tomorrow from 2 in the afternoon until 6 p.m., just like always. In fact, you're interviewing Clarence Clemens in the studio at 4. You know Clarence Clemens, Rich? As in, come on and blow, big man?"
"Clemens can talk to Mike O'Hara as well as he can to me."
"Clarence doesn't want to talk to Mike, Rich. Clarence doesn't want to talk to Bobby Russell. He doesn't want to talk to me. Clarence is a big fan of Buford Kiss Drivel and Wyatt the Homicidal Bag Boy. He wants to talk to you, my friend. And I have no interest in having a pissed-off 250-pound saxophone player who was once almost drafted by a pro football team running amok in my studio."
"I don't think he has a history of running amok," Rich said. "I mean, we're talking Clarence Clemens here, not Keith Moon."
There was silence on the line. Rich waited patiently.
"You're not serious, are you?" Steve finally asked. He sounded plaintive. "I mean, unless your mother just died or you've got a brain tumor out or something, this is called crapping out."
"I have to go, Steve."
"Is your mother sick? Did she, God forbid, die?"
"She died 10 years ago."
"Have you got a brain tumor?"
"Not even a rectal polyp."
"This is not funny, Rich."
"No."
"You've been a fucking busher, and I don't like it."
"I don't like it either, but I have to go."
"Where? Why? What is this? Talk to me, Rich."
"Someone called me. Someone I used to know a long time ago in another place. Back then, something happened. I made a promise. We all promised that we would go back if the something started happening again, and I guess it has."
"What something are we talking about, Rich?"
"I'd just as soon not say. Also, you'll think I'm crazy if I tell you the truth. I don't remember."
"When did you make this famous promise?"
"A long time ago, in the summer of 1958. There was another long pause. And he knew Steve Koval was trying to decide if Rich Records Tozier, a.k.a. Buford Kissdrivel, a.k.a. Wyatt the Homicidal Bag Boy, etc., was having him on or was having some kind of mental breakdown.
"You would have been just a kid,"
Steve said flatly.
11.
Going on 12. Another long pause. Rich waited patiently.
"All right," Steve said. "I'll shift the rotation, put Mike in for you. I can call Chuck Foster to pull a few shifts, I guess, if I can find what Chinese restaurant he's currently holed up in. I'll do it because we go back a long way together, but I'm never going to forget you bushed out on me, Rich."
"Oh, get down off it," Rich said, but the headache was getting worse. He knew what he was doing. Did Steve really think he didn't? "I need a few days off is all. You're acting like I took a shit on our FCC charter."
"A few days off? For what? The reunion of your Cub Scout pack in Shithouse Falls, North Dakota, or Pussy Hump City, West Virginia?"
"Well, actually, I think Shithouse Falls is in Arkansas, Bo,"
Buford Kissdrivel said in his big, hollow barrel voice, but Steve was not to be diverted.
"Because you made a promise when you were 11? Kids don't make serious promises when they're 11, for Christ's sake. It's not even that, Rich, and you know it. This is not an insurance company. This is not a law office. This is show business, be it ever so humble, and you fucking well know it. If you had given me a week's notice, I wouldn't be holding this phone in one hand and a bottle of Mylanta in the other. You have put my balls to the wall, and you know it, so don't you insult my intelligence."
Steve was nearly screaming now, and Rich closed his eyes. "I'm never going to forget it," Steve had said, and Rich supposed he never would.
But Steve had also said kids didn't make serious promises when they were 11, and that wasn't true at all. Rich couldn't remember what the promise had been, wasn't sure he wanted to remember. But it had been plenty serious. Steve, I have to. Yeah, and I told you I could handle it. So go ahead. Go ahead, you busher.
Steve, this is
But Steve had already hung up.
Rich put the phone down. He had barely started away from it when it began to ring again. And he knew without picking it up that it was Steve again, madder than ever. Talking to him at this point would do no good. Things would just get uglier. He slid the switch on the side of the phone to the right, cutting it off in mid-ring. He went upstairs, pulled two suitcases out of the closet, and filled them with a barely glanced-at conglomeration of clothes, jeans, shirts, underwear, socks. It would not occur to him until later that he had taken nothing but kid clothes. He carried the suitcases back downstairs. On the den wall was a black-and-white Ansel Adams photograph of Big Sur. Rich swung it back on hidden hinges, exposing a barrel safe. He opened it, pawed his way past the paperwork, the house here, poised cozily between the fault line and the brush fire zone, 20 acres of timberland in Idaho, a bunch of stocks. He had bought the stocks seemingly at random. When his broker saw Rich coming, he immediately clutched his head, but the stocks had all risen steadily over the years. He was sometimes surprised by the thought that he was almost, not quite, but almost, a rich man, all courtesy of rock and roll music, and the voices, of course. House, acres, stocks, insurance policy, even a copy of his last will and testament. The strings that bind you tight to the map of your life, he thought. There was a sudden wild impulse to whip out his Zippo and light it up. The whole whore's combine of wherefores and know ye all men by these presents and the bearer of this certificate is entitled. And he could do it, too. The papers in his safe had suddenly ceased to signify anything. The first real terror struck him then, and there was nothing at all supernatural about it. It was only a realization of how easy it was to trash your life. That was what was so scary. You just dragged the fan up to everything you had spent the years raking together and turn the motherfucker on. Easy. Burn it up or blow it away. Then just take a powder. Behind the papers, which were only currency's second cousins, was the real stuff, the cash. $4,000 in tens, twenties, and fifties. Taking it now, stuffing it into the pocket of his jeans, he wondered if he hadn't somehow known what he was doing when he put the money in here. $50 one month, 120 the next, maybe only 10 the month after that. Rat hole money. Taking a powder money. Man, that's scary, he said, barely aware he had spoken. He was looking blankly out the big window at the beach. It was deserted now. The surfers gone, the honeymooners, if that was what they had been, gone too. Ah, yes, Doc, it all comes back to me now. Remember Stanley Uris, for instance. Bet your fur I do. Remember how we used to say that and think it was so cool? Stanley Urin, the big kids called him. Hey, Urin, hey, you fucking Christ killer, where are you going? One of your fag friends gonna give you a BJ? He slammed the safe door shut and swung the picture back into place. When had he last thought of Stan Urus? 5 years ago? 10? 20? Rich and his family had moved away from Derry in the spring of 1960, and how fast all of their faces faded. His gang, that pitiful bunch of losers with their little clubhouse in what had been known then as the Barrens, funny name for an area as lush with growth as that place had been, kidding themselves that they were jungle explorers or sea bees carving out a landing strip on a Pacific atoll while they held off the Japs, kidding themselves that they were dam builders, cowboys, spacemen on a jungle world, you name it. But whatever you name it, don't let's forget what it really was. It was hiding. Hiding from the big kids, hiding from Henry Bowers and Victor Criss and Belch Huggins and the rest of them. What a bunch of losers they had been. Stan Urus with his big Jew boy nose, Bill Denbro, who could say nothing but hi-o silver without stuttering so badly that it drove you almost dog shit. Beverly Marsh with her bruises and her cigarettes rolled into the sleeve of her blouse. Ben Hanscom, who'd been so big he looked like a human version of Moby Dick. And Richie Tozier, with his thick glasses and his A averages and his wise mouth and his face, which just begged to be pounded into new and exciting shapes. Was there a word for what they had been? Oh, yes, there always was. Le mot juste. In this case, le mot juste was wimps. How it came back. How all of it came back. And now he stood here in his den, shivering as helplessly as a homeless mutt caught in a thunderstorm. Shivering because the guys he had run with weren't all he remembered. There were other things. Things he hadn't thought of in years, trembling just below the surface. Bloody things. A darkness. Some darkness. The house on Niebolt Street, and Bill screaming, "You killed my brother, you fucker!" Did he remember? Just enough not to want to remember anymore, and you could bet your fur on that. A smell of garbage, a smell of shit, and a smell of something else, something worse than either. It was the stink of the beast, the stink of it. Down there in the darkness under Derry, where the machines thundered on and on, he remembered George. But that was too much, and he ran for the bathroom, blundering into his Eames chair on his way and almost falling. He made it. Barely. He slid across the slick tiles to the toilet on his knees like some weird breakdancer, gripped the edges, and vomited everything in his guts. Even then it wouldn't stop. Suddenly he could see Georgie Denbrough as if he had last seen him yesterday. Georgie, who had been the start of it all, Georgie, who had been murdered in the fall of 1957. Georgie had died right after the flood. One of his arms had been ripped from its socket, and Rich had blocked all of that out of his memory. But sometimes those things come back. Oh, yes, indeedy. They come back. Sometimes they come back. The spasm passed, and Rich groped blindly for the flush. Water roared. His early supper, regurgitated in hot chunks, vanished tastefully down the drain. Into the sewers. Into the pound and stink. And darkness of the sewers. He closed the lid, laid his forehead against it, and began to cry. It was the first time he had cried since his mother died in 1975. Without even thinking of what he was doing, he cupped his hands under his eyes, and the contact lenses he wore slipped out and lay glistening in his palms. 40 minutes later, feeling husked out and somehow cleansed, he threw his suitcases into the trunk of his MG and backed it out of the garage. The light was fading. He looked at his house with the new plantings. He looked at the beach, at the water, which had taken on the cast of pale emeralds broken by a narrow track of beaten gold. And a conviction stole over him that he would never see any of this again, that he was a dead man walking. "Going home now," Rich Tozier whispered to himself. "Going home. God help me. Going home." He put the car in gear and went, feeling again how easy it had been to slip through an unsuspected fissure in what he had considered a solid life, how easy it was to get over onto the dark side, to sail out of the blue and into the black. Out of the blue and into the black. Yes, that was it. Where anything might be waiting.